Sea Smoke, Tessarion, and Vermithor. The Battle of 131 AC. Battle of the King's Road, dubbed by those who fought in it the Muddy Mess, which was the last battle of the war. This resulted in the death of Lord Boros Baratheon at the hands of young Lord Tully.
An end did come at last, but it was not the deaths of dragons or of princes that brought it about, but instead the death of the queen and the king, for whom they, and tens of thousands more, had perished. Rhaenyra died first. When her husband, Prince Daemon, fell, House Velaryon turned against her. With her enemies once more in possession of King's Landing, she fled practically penniless, and was forced to sell her crown to find passage to Dragonstone. But when she arrived, she found a freshly injured Aegon II there before her, with his dying dragon, Sunfire.
Madness gripped the city after Rhaenyra fled, and it showed itself in many ways. Strangest of all was the rise of two pretender kings who reigned during the time, remembered as the Moon of the Three Kings. The first was Tristane Truefire, a squire to a disreputable hedge knight named Sir Perkin the Flea, who Sir Perkin declared was the natural son of Viserys the First. After the storming of the Dragon Pit and Rhaenyra's flight, the shepherd and his mob ruled much of the city, but Sir Perkin installed Tristane in the abandoned Red Keep and began to issue edicts. When Aegon II eventually retook the city, Tristane begged the boon of knighthood before he was executed, and this he received. The other king was curiouser still, a child who became known as Gaemon Palehair. The son of a whore, this four-year-old boy was claimed to be a bastard of Aegon II, which was not improbable, given the king's bawdy ways in his youth. From his seat in the House of Kisses, atop Visenya's Hill, he gathered followers by the thousands and issued a series of edicts. His mother later was hanged, having confessed he was the son of a silver-haired oarsman from Lys, but Gaemon was spared and taken into the king's household. In time, he befriended Aegon III, becoming his constant companion and food taster for some years, before dying of poison that might have been intended for the king himself.
Monken's true telling, based on Orwell's account, reveals that when King's Landing fell, Lara Strong saw to it that the king was spirited away to hide. Cunningly, Strong sent him to Dragonstone, rightly believing that Rhaenyra would never think to look for her brother at her own stronghold. For half a year he recovered from his wounds in a remote fishing village, whilst Rhaenyra and much of her court were in King's Landing. And during that time, Sunfire arrived from Crackclaw Point, despite the dragon's crippled wing, which made it ungainly in the air. Thus hidden, they were able to recover their strength. Sunfire went on to kill the shy wild dragon called the Grey Ghost, leading to confused reports claiming that it was the cannibal that did it. King Aegon found many around Dragonstone who had grievances against Rhaenyra for the loss of sons, husbands, and brothers in her war, or for slights they imagined. And with their aid, he conquered Dragonstone. It took no more than an hour, largely unopposed as it was, except for Prince Daemon's daughter, the 14-year-old Baela Targaryen, and her young dragon, Moondancer. Baela had escaped the men who tried to seize her, and had made her way to her dragon, and as Aegon II sought to land in the courtyard of the castle on Sunfire, thinking himself triumphant, the dragon and the princess rose to meet him. Moondancer was much smaller than Sunfire, but also much swifter, and far more nimble, and neither the dragon nor the princess on her back lacked courage. The dragon swooped and clawed and snapped at Sunfire, raking and tearing until at last a blast of flame blinded the beast. Tangled together, the two dragons fell, and their riders with them. Aegon II leapt at the last moment from Sunfire's back, both legs shattering, while Bela remained with Moondancer to the bitter end. When Alfred Broom drew his sword to kill her, where she lay broken and unconscious, Sir Marston Waters tore the sword from his grasp and carried her to the Maester, saving her life. Of this great battle, Rhaenyra knew nothing, but it did not matter. Aegon II, ever spiteful of his sister and enraged at the agony of his shattered legs and the impending death of his dragon, fed Rhaenyra to Sunfire before the eyes of her sole surviving son, so far as any man or woman in the Seven Kingdoms knew, Aegon the Younger. So passed the realm's delight, the half-year queen, on the 22nd day of the 10th moon of 130 AC. Her half-brother did not long survive her. Though Rhaenyra was dead and Aegon the Younger was in his hands, Aegon II still had many enemies who continued to fight against him. They fought as much out of fear of his reprisals as they did for Rhaenyra. But they fought, and they proved the greater foe. When Lord Boris Baratheon at last stirred with his strength, marching against what remained of Rhaenyra's forces, there might have been a chance to turn the tide. But Lord Boris fell at the Battle of the King's Road, his host shattered, and the young river lords known as the Lads, whose host had defeated him, were within a stone's throw of the city, while Lord Stark was coming down the King's Road with a host of his own. It was at this time that Lord Corlys Velaryon, freed from the dungeons and pardoned, and now serving on the King's small council, advised Aegon to surrender and take the Black. The King refused, however, and planned to give orders to have his young nephew's ear removed as a warning to Aegon the Younger's supporters. He climbed into his litter to be carried to his apartments and was given a cup of wine on the way. When his escort arrived with the litter and lifted the curtain, they found the king dead, with blood on his lips. And so ended King Aegon II, poisoned by the men who served him, for they had seen the end even if he had not. The broken, shattered realm suffered for a while yet, but the dance of the dragons was done. Now what awaited the realm was the false dawn, the hour of the wolf, the rule of the regents, and the broken king.
The Dragons in the Dance. King Aegon II's Dragons. Sunfire. King Aegon. Splendid but young, crippled for much of the war after Rook's Rest, then slain in battle with the dragon Moondancer at Dragonstone. Vhagar, Prince Aemon One-Eye, the last of Aegon the Conqueror's three dragons, old but huge and powerful, killed in battle with Caraxes above the god's eye. Dreamfire, Queen Helena, once the dragon of Jaehaerys the First's sister, Rhaena, crushed beneath the collapsing dome at the storming of the dragon pit. Tessarion, Prince Daeron, the Blue Queen, the youngest of the dragons of fighting weight belonging to Aegon's supporters, killed at Second Tumbleton. Morgul, Princess Jaehaera, too young for war, killed at the storming of the dragon pit by the burning night. Shrykos, Prince Jaehaerys, too young for war, killed at the storming of the dragon pit by Hob the Hewer. Queen Rhaenyra's Dragons. Syrax, Queen Rhaenyra, huge and formidable, killed at the storming of the dragon pit. Caraxes, Prince Daemon, the bloodworm, huge and formidable, killed in battle with Vhagar above the god's eye. Vermax, Prince Jacaerys, young but strong, killed with his rider at the Battle of the Gullet. Arryx, Prince Lucerys, young but strong, killed with his rider by Vhagar above Shipbreaker Bay. Tyraxes, Prince Joffrey, young but strong, killed at the storming of the Dragon Pit. Stormcloud, Prince Aegon the Younger, killed by arrow and bolt at the Battle of the Gullet. Meles, Princess Rhaenys, the Red Queen, old and cunning, lazy, but fearsome when roused, killed at Rook's Roost with her rider, the Queen Who Never Was. Moondancer, Lady Bela, slender and beautiful, just large enough to carry a girl, killed by Sunfire at Dragonstone, but not before dealing a mortal wound. Silver Wing, Sir Ulf the White, Good Queen Alysanne's dragon, mounted by a dragon seed and betrayer, survived him and the dance both, but became wild and made her lair in an isle in Red Lake. Sea Smoke, Adam of Hull, once Selena Velaryon's dragon, mounted by a dragon seed, killed by Vermithor at Second Tumbleton. Vermithor, Sir Hugh Hammer, old and hoary, the Old King's Mount, mounted by a dragon seed and betrayer, killed in battle with Sea Smoke and Tessarion at Second Tumbleton. Sheepstealer, Nettles, a wild dragon tamed by a dragon seed, vanished at War's End. Grey Ghost, a wild dragon, shy of people, never tamed, killed by Sunfire at Dragonstone. The Cannibal, a wild dragon, a scavenger and killer of hatchlings, never tamed, and vanished at War's End. Mourning, Lady Rhaena, too young for war, survived the dance.
Aegon the Third. When Aegon the Younger came to the Iron Throne in 131 AC as Aegon the Third, after the death of his uncle Aegon the Second, the realm may well have thought that its troubles were done. Aegon the Third's supporters had defeated the last of Aegon the Second's host at the Battle of the King's Road, and had full control of King's Landing. The Velaryon fleet once more served the Iron Throne, and the Sea Snake would surely help to guide the young king. But these hopes were built on sand, and this period was soon known as the False Dawn. Aegon II had sent men across the narrow sea in search of sellswords, and none knew when or if those would return to avenge their king. In the west, the Red Kraken and his reavers ravished Fair Isle and the western coast, and a terrible hard winter, first declared by the conclave in Oldtown in 130 AC on Maiden's Day, had taken a firm grip on the realm, and would last for 6 cruel years. Nowhere in the Seven Kingdoms did the winter matter more than in the north, and the fear of such a winter had driven the Winter Wolves to gather beneath the banner of Lord Roderick Dustin and die fighting for Queen Rhaenyra. But behind them came a greater army of childless and homeless men, unwed men, old men, and younger sons, under the banner of Lord Craigan Stark. They had come for war, for adventure and plunder, and for a glorious death to spare their kin beyond the neck one more mouth to feed. The poisoning of King Aegon II had denied them that chance. Lord Stark still marched his army into King's Landing, but to a much different outcome. He had planned to punish Storm's End, Old Town, and Castle Rock for having supported the king. But Lord Corlys had already sent envoys to the Rock and Storm's End and Old Town, suing for peace. for 6 days while the court waited for news of Lord Corliss's success or failure, and the realm trembled at the thought of more war. Lord Craigan Stark held sway at court. This came to be known as the Hour of the Wolf. Yet in one thing Lord Stark would not be dissuaded. The betrayers and poisoners of King Aegon II must pay the price. To kill a cruel and unjust king in lawful battle was one thing. But foul murder and the use of poison was a betrayal against the very gods who had anointed him. Craigan had 22 men arrested in Aegon III's name, among them Laris Clubfoot and Carlos Velaryon. Cowed, the young Aegon III, who was 11 at the time, agreed to make Lord Stark his hand. Craigan Stark served in that office for a single day, presiding over the trials and executions. Most of the accused took the black, led by the cunning Sir Perkin the Flea. Two alone chose death. Sir Giles Belgrave of the King's Guard, who did not wish to outlive his king, and Laris the Clubfoot, the last of the ancient line of House Strong.
Lord Corliss was spared a trial by the machinations of Baelor and Rhaenyra Targaryen, who convinced Aegon to issue an edict restoring to him his offices and honours, then by Black Alley Blackwood, when she gave Lord Stark her hand in marriage in return for the boon of allowing Aegon's edict to stand.
The day after the executions, Lord Stark resigned his hand. No man ever held the office so briefly, and few left it as gladly. He returned to the north, leaving many of his fierce northmen behind in the south. Some wed widows in the Riverlands, others sold their swords or swore them in service, and a few turned to banditry. But the Hour of the Wolf was done, and it was time for the regents. The period of Aegon's regency, which stretched from 131 AC when he inherited the throne to 136 AC when he came of age, was presided over by a council of seven. Only one of those regents, Grand Maester Monkin, lasted for the whole of the term. The others died and resigned and were replaced as needed. Of these, the greatest was the Sea Snake, who passed from this vale of tears and 132 AC at the age of 79. For 7 days his body lay in state beneath the Iron Throne, and the realm wept. The years of Aegon's regency were marked by turmoil. Sir Tywin Lannister, one of the men who had returned empty-handed from the free cities, for the free companies were richly paid during the wars that followed the collapse of the kingdom of the Three Daughters, served ably as hand of the king, despite the blinding and mutilations he suffered at the hands of Queen Rhaenyra's torturers, when he refused to divulge where he had hidden much of Aegon II's royal treasury. But the winter fever took him in 133. Matters deteriorated further when Onwin Peak, Lord of Starpike, Dunstanbury and White Grove, became first a regent, then the hand. He had played a significant role at first and second Tumbleton, and had felt slighted when he was not chosen to be among the first regents. But he soon made up for that, acquiring more and more power. He saw his kin hold many high offices, attempted to wed his own daughter to King Aegon III, following the apparent suicide of Queen Jehera, and endeavour to weaken his rivals by any means at hand.
The regents of King Aegon III. The First Council of Seven. Lady Jane Arryn, the Maiden of the Vale, dead of illness in Gulltown in 134 AC. Lord Corliss Velaryon, the Sea Snake, dead of old age in 132 AC, aged 79. Lord Roland Westerling of the Crag, dead of the winter fever in 133 AC. Lord Royce Caron of Nightsong gave up his place in 132 AC. Lord Manfred Mouton of Maidenpool, dead of age and illness in 134 AC. Sir Torin Manderley of White Harbour gave up his place in 132 AC following the death of his father and brother from the winter fever. Grand Maester Munken, the only man to hold the office from 131 AC to 136 AC. The rest. Lord Unwin Peake, given Lord Corliss's seat in 132 AC, resigned in 134 AC. Lord Thaddeus Rowan, given a place in 133 AC, following the death of Lord Westerling, and relieved of his office in 136 AC. Sir Corwin Corbray, husband to Rhaenar Targaryen, replaced Lord Mouton in 134 AC, and killed by a crossbowman at Runestone that same year. Willem Stackspear, chosen by lot in the Great Council of 136 AC. Mark Merriweather, chosen by lot in the Great Council of 136 AC. Laurent Grandison, chosen by lot in the Great Council of 136 AC.
Lord Arran, the Sea Snake's grandson, was chief among the Hand's rivals. He was refused his father's place as a regent, then was made to sail against the Stepstones. There he won the name of Oakenfist, following a great victory at sea. But his newborn fame proved divisive when he returned to King's Landing. The Hand had intended to seize control of the Stepstones and put an end to the pirate kingdom of Recalio Rindoon. But Velaryon's swift action meant that the greater part of the fleet could not land the forces needed to accomplish this. Oakenfist's fame and reputation only increased in the wake of his victory, winning him honors and rewards from the regents despite Lord Peake's protests. In the end, the Hand convinced the regents to dispatch Oakenfist to the Westerlands to deal with the Red Kraken's longships when Lord Dalton Greyjoy refused to give up his prizes and cease his reaving. This was a perilous journey, intended almost certainly to result in Lord Allen's defeat or death. Instead, Oakenfist turned it into the first of his six great voyages.
The last living offspring of Aegon II, Jaehaera Targaryen, was 8 when she wed her cousin Aegon III, and 10 when she threw herself from Maegor's holdfast to the spikes of the dry moat below. She lived on for half an hour in agony before she died. Yet some question the manner of her death. Was it truly by her own hand? Some whispered that she was murdered, and many suspects were named. Among them was Sir Mervyn Flowers of the Kingsguard, the bastard brother of Lord Unwin Peake, who had been at her door when she died. Yet even Mushroom thinks it unlikely that Flowers was the kind of man to push his charge, a child, to such an ugly death. He suggests a different possibility, that Flowers did not kill her, but stepped aside to let someone else do the deed. Someone like the unscrupulous Free City sellsword Tessario the Tiger, whom Lord Unwin had brought into his service. Though we will never know the truth of the events that day, it now seems likely that Jaehaera's death was somehow instigated by Lord Peake.
In all this, Aegon III, too young to rule, was but a pawn. He was a melancholy youth and sullen, interested in very little. He always wore black and might go for days without speaking a word to anyone. His only companion in these first years was Gaemon Palehair, the boy pretender, now his servant and friend. After Lord Peake came to power, Gaiman was given a new role as the king's whipping boy, to suffer the punishments that could not be meted out against the royal person. Later, Gaiman Palehair died in the attempted poisoning of the king and his young, beautiful queen, Daenerys Velaryon. Lady Daenerys was a cousin to Alan Oakenfist, fathered by his cousin, Daeron, who died fighting for him in the Stepstones. A surpassingly beautiful child, Daenerys was but six when the princesses, Rhaena and Baela, presented her to the king. The last of 1,000 maids who had been presented him at the great ball of 133 AC. This ball had been declared by the Hand Lord Peake after the regent stopped his efforts to betroth his own daughter to the king, though he did not give up that aspiration and was greatly frustrated by the king's ultimate choice. His efforts to have the choice put aside were opposed by both Aegon and the other regents. Outraged, Lord Unwin threatened to resign the handship to bend the regents to his will, only to find the others delighted to oblige him. They appointed one of their number, Lord Thaddeus Rowan, to take his place as hand. Aegon had only one true joy during these years, the return of his younger brother, Prince Viserys. The realm had thought Viserys slain at the Battle of the Gullet, and the king had never forgiven himself for abandoning his brother when he fled on the back of his dragon, Stormcloud. But Viserys was eventually recovered from Lys by Oakenfist, where he had been held in secret by merchant princes who thought to profit from his ransom or his death. The price that Lord Velaryon agreed to for his release was enormous, and soon proved a matter of contention. But his release, with his new Lyseni bride, the beautiful Lera Roger, 7 years his elder, was a joy regardless, and for the rest of his days he was the only person Aegon ever fully trusted. In the end it was Lera Roger and her wealthy, ambitious family who helped break the power of the regents and almost certainly that of Lord Peake. It was an inadvertent role they played, however, caught up as they were in the Lyseni Spring. This was a time when the Roger Bank waxed greater than the Iron Bank, and so fell prey to the plots to control the king. They were blamed for many more acts than they were actually guilty of. Lord Rowan, then the Hand and one of the last regents, was accused of being complicit in their crimes and was tortured for information. Sir Marston Waters, now somehow Hand of the King in his place, Munkin the only regent at this time besides Rowan, is reticent to discuss this in the true telling. Dispatched men to seize Lady Lera after having arrested her brothers. But the king and his brother refused to give her up, and were besieged in Magor's Holdfast by Waters and his supporters for 18 days. The conspiracy eventually unraveled as Sir Marston, perhaps recalling his duty, attempted to fulfill his king's command to arrest those who had falsely implicated the Rogers and Lord Rowan. Waters himself was killed by his own sworn brother, Sir Mervyn Flowers, when he attempted to arrest him. Order re-established itself, with Munkin serving as hand and regent for the rest of the remaining year, until new regents were appointed and a new hand was found. The time of regency finally ended on the 16th name day of the king, when he entered the small council chamber, dismissed his regents, and relieved his then hand, Lord Manderley, of his office.
From the account of Grand Maester Munkin of the King's words to Lord Manderley when he ended the regency. I mean to give the small folk peace and food and justice. If that will not suffice to win their love, let Mushroom make a progress. Or perhaps we might send a dancing bear. Someone once told me that the commons love nothing half so much as dancing bears. You may call a halt to this feast tonight as well. Send the lords home to their own keeps and give the food to the hungry. Full bellies and dancing bears shall be my policy."
It was a broken reign that followed, for Aegon himself was broken. He was melancholy to the end of his days, found pleasure in almost nothing, and locked himself in his chambers to brood for days on end. He likewise came to dislike being touched, even by the hand of his beautiful queen. Even after she had flowered, he was long in calling her to his bed. But ultimately, their marriage was blessed, with two sons and three daughters. The eldest Daeron was named the Prince of Dragonstone and heir apparent. Though he strove to give the realm peace and plenty in the wake of the dance, Aegon III proved unwilling to court his own people or his lords. His might have been a very different reign were it not for that one flaw in him, his coldness when it came to those he ruled. His brother, Prince Viserys, who in his last years served as his hand, had the gift of charm, but he himself grew stern after his wife abandoned him and their children for her native Lys. Yet together Aegon and Viserys ably dealt with the remaining turmoil in the realm. One such incident was the troublesome appearance of several pretenders claiming to be Prince Daeron the Daring, the youngest brother of Aegon II, who was killed at Second Tumbledon, but whose body was never identified, leaving the door open for unscrupulous men to make their false claims. But those feigned princes have since been conclusively shown to be imposters. They even attempted to restore the Targaryen dragons, despite Aegon's fears, for which none could blame him, after witnessing his mother being eaten alive. He dreaded the sight of dragons, and had even less desire to ride upon one. But he was convinced that they would cow those who sought to oppose him. At Viserys' suggestion, he sent away for 9 mages from Essos, attempting to use their arts to kindle a clutch of eggs. This proved both a debacle and a failure. There were 4 dragons still living at the start of his reign: Silverwing, Mourning, Sheepstealer, and the Cannonball. Yet Aegon III will always be remembered as the Dragonbane, for the last Targaryen dragon died during his reign in the year 153 AC. The reign of the Broken King, also known as Aegon the Unlucky, ended with the king's death at 36 years of age, from consumption. Many of his subjects thought him far older, for his boyhood was cut too short. The melancholy king is not remembered fondly, and his legacy would pale before that of his sons. Daeron the First. When Aegon III died in the 26th year of his reign, 157 years after the conqueror was crowned, he left behind 2 sons and 3 daughters. The eldest of his sons, Daeron, was a mere boy of 14 years when he assumed the throne. Perhaps because of Daeron's charm and genius, or perhaps because of his memory of what transpired during the regency of Daeron's father, Prince Viserys chose not to insist on a regency while the young king was in his minority. Instead, Viserys continued to serve as hand, while King Daeron ruled ably and capably. Few foresaw that Daeron, the first of his name, would cover himself in glory as did his ancestor, Aegon the Conqueror, whose crown he wore. His father had preferred a simple circlet. Yet that glory turned to ashes almost as swiftly. A youth of rare brilliance and forcefulness, Daeron at first met resistance from his uncle, his counselors, and many great lords, when he first proposed to complete the conquest by bringing Dawn into the realm at last. His lords reminded him that, unlike the conqueror and his sisters, he had no more dragons fit for war. To this, Daeron famously responded, "You have a dragon. he stands before you. In the end, the king could not be gainsaid, and when he revealed his plans formulated, it is said, with the help and advice of Alan Valarian, the Oakenfist, some began to think it could indeed be done, for the proposed campaign improved upon that of Aegon's own. Darren the First amply proved his prowess on the Field of Dawn, which for hundreds of years had defied the Reach, the Stormlords, and even the dragons of House Targaryen. Darren divided his host into three forces, one led by Lord Tyrell, who came down the Princess Pass at the western end of the Red Mountains of Dawn, one led by the king's cousin and master of ships, Alan Valarian, travelling by sea, and one led by the king himself, marching down the treacherous pass called the Boneway, where he made use of goat tracks that others considered too dangerous, to go around the Dornish watchtowers and avoid the same traps that had caught Orys Baratheon. The young king then swept away every force that sought to stop him. The Prince's Pass was won, and most importantly the royal fleet broke the Planky Town and then was able to drive upriver. With Dorne effectively divided in half by Lord Alan's control of the Green Blood, the Dornish forces in the east and west could not aid one another directly, and from this stemmed a series of bold battles that would take a volume entire to relate in full. Many accounts of this war can be found, but the best of them is The Conquest of Dorne, King Darren's own account of his campaign, which is rightly considered a marvel of elegant simplicity in both its prose and its strategies. Within a year, the invaders were at the gates of Sunspear and battling their way through the so-called Shadow City. In 158 AC, the Prince of Dorne and 20 of the most powerful Dornish lords bent their knees to Darren at the submission of Sunspear. The young dragon had accomplished what Aegon the Conqueror never had. There were rebels still in the deserts and mountains, men swiftly branded as outlaws, but they were few in number to begin with. The king quickly consolidated his control of Dorne, dealing with these rebels when he found them, though not without difficulty. In one infamous episode, a poison arrow meant for the king was taken instead by his cousin, Prince Aemon, the younger son of Prince Viserys, who had to be sent home by ship to recover. Yet, by 159 AC, the hinterlands were pacified, and the young dragon was free to return in triumph to King's Landing, leaving Lord Tyrell in Dorne to keep the peace. As assurance for Dorne's future loyalty and good behavior, 14 high-born hostages were carried back with him to King's Landing, the sons and daughters of almost all the great houses of Dorne. This tactic proved less effective than Darren might have hoped, however. Whilst the hostages helped ensure the continued loyalty of their own blood, the king had not anticipated the tenacity of Dorne's small folk, over whom he had no hold. 10,000 men, it is said, died in the battle for Dorne. 40,000 more died over the course of the following 3 years, as common Dornishmen fought on stubbornly against the king's men. Lord Tyrell, whom Darren had left in charge of Dorne, valiantly attempted to quell the fires of rebellion, travelling from castle to castle with each turn of the moon, punishing any supporters of the rebels with a noose, burning down the villages that harboured the outlaws, and so on. But the small folk struck back, and each new day found supplies stolen or destroyed, camps burned, horses killed, and slowly the count of dead soldiers and men-at-arms rose. Killed in the alleyways of the Shadow City, ambushed amidst the dunes, murdered in their camps. But the true rebellion began when Lord Tyrell and his train travelled to Sandstone, where his lordship was murdered in a bed of scorpions. As word spread of his demise, open rebellion swept Dawn from one end to the other.
Dawnish letters recorded in Maester Gareth's Red Sands suggest that Lord Corgyle, the Lord of Sandstone, himself arranged for Lord Tyrell's murder. However, his motives were the subject of speculation in later years. Some say he grew angry that his early show of loyalty, by putting an end to the rabble-rousing of one of the more notorious rebel lords, was given such little consideration by Lord Tyrell, whilst others claimed that his initial aid was all part of a treacherous plan he made with his castellan to lull the king and Lord Tyrell into trusting him.
In 160 AC, the young dragon himself was forced to return to Dawn to put down the rebels. He won several small victories as he fought through the Boneway, while Lord Alan Oakenfist descended once again upon the Planky Town and the Greenblood. Apparently broken in 161 AC, the Dornishmen agreed to meet to renew their fealty and discuss terms. But it was treachery and murder they plotted, not peace. In a bloody betrayal, the Dornish attacked the young dragon and his retinue beneath the peace banner. Three knights of the king's guard were slain, attempting to protect the king. A fourth, to his eternal shame, threw down his sword and yielded. Prince Aemon, the dragon knight, was wounded and captured, but not before cutting down two of the betrayers. The young dragon himself died, with black fire in his hand, surrounded by a dozen enemies. King Dairon the First's reign was thus 4 short years in length. His ambition had proved too great. Glory may be everlasting, yet it is fleeting as well. Soon forgotten in the aftermath of even the most famous of victories, if they lead to greater disasters. Baelor the First. News soon reached King's Landing of King Dairon's death and the rout of his remaining forces. The outrage that followed was swiftly directed at the Dornish hostages. At the command of the king's hand, Prince Viserys, they were thrown into the dungeons to await hanging. The hand's eldest son, Prince Aegon, even delivered the Dornish girl he had made his paramour to his father to await execution. The young dragon had never married, nor fathered children. Accordingly, upon his death, the Iron Throne passed to his brother, Baelor, a youth of 10 and 7. Baelor proved to be the most pious king in the Targaryen dynasty, and some say in the history of all the 7 kingdoms. His first act as king was to grant pardon to the Dornish hostages. Many similar acts of piety and forgiveness followed throughout Baelor's 10-year reign. Even as his lords and council cried for vengeance, Baelor publicly forgave his brother's killers and declared that he meant to bind up the wounds of his brother's war and make peace with Dawn. As an act of piety, he declared he would go to Dawn with neither sword nor army to return their hostages and sue for peace. And so he did, walking barefoot from King's Landing to Sunspear, clad only in sackcloth, while the hostages rode fine horses behind him. There are many songs of Baelor's journey to Dawn that found their way out of septuaries and mother houses to spill from the tongues of singers. Mounting the stone way, Baelor soon came to the place where the Wills had imprisoned his cousin, Prince Aemon. He found the Dragon Knight naked in a cage. It is said that Baelor pleaded, but Lord Will refused to free Aemon, forcing his grace instead to offer a prayer for his cousin and swear that he would return. Many generations since have wondered just what Prince Aemon must have thought of this, seeing his reedy voice, slender kinsman, haggard and with bare bleeding feet, making this promise. And yet Baelor pressed on and survived the Boneway, which had proved the undoing for many thousands before him. The crossing of the desert between the northern foothills and the scourge, on foot, practically alone, nearly undid him. And yet he persevered. It was an arduous journey, but he survived to meet with the Prince of Dawn in what some consider to be the first miracle of Blessed Balor's reign. And the second miracle might well be that he succeeded in forging a peace with Dawn that lasted throughout his reign. As part of the terms of the agreement, Balor agreed that his young cousin, Daeron, grandson of his hand, Viserys, and the son of Viserys' eldest son, Prince Aegon, should be betrothed to Princess Moriah, eldest child of the Prince of Dawn. Both were children at the time, so the marriage was to take place when they were of age. After a sojourn in the old palace at Sunspear, the Prince of Dawn offered Balor a galley to take him back to King's Landing. However, the young king insisted that the Seven had commanded him to walk. Some in the Dornish court feared that Prince Viserys would take it as a new cause for war when, not if, Balor died upon the road. So the prince made every effort to make certain that the Dornish lords along the route would be hospitable. When he mounted the Boneway, Balor turned his attention to recovering Prince Aemon from his imprisonment. He had asked the Dornish prince to explicitly command the Dragon Knight's release, and this lord will accept it. Yet instead of freeing Aemon himself, he gave Balor the key to Aemon's cage and an invitation to use it. But now, not only was Aemon naked in a cage, exposed to the hot sun by day and the cold wind by night, but also a pit had been dug beneath the cage, and within it were many vipers. The Dragon Knight is said to have begged the king to leave him, to go and seek aid in the Dornish marches instead. But Balor is said to have smiled and told him that the guards would protect him. Then he stepped into the pit. Later, the singers claimed that the vipers bowed their heads to Balor as he passed. But the truth is otherwise. Balor was bitten half a dozen times while crossing to the cage, and though he opened it, he nearly collapsed before the Dragon Knight was able to thrust open the door and pull his cousin from the pit. The Wills are said to have laid wagers as Prince Aemon struggled to climb out of the cage, with Balor flung across his back, and perhaps it was their cruelty that spurred him to climb to the top of the cage and leap to safety. Prince Aemon carried Balor halfway down the Boneway before a village septon in the Dornish mountains gave him clothing and an ass on which to carry the comatose king. Eventually Aemon reached the watchtowers of the Dondarrions, and then was conducted to Blackhaven, where the local maester cared for the king as best he could before sending them on to Storm's End for further treatment. And all the while, it is said, Balor was wasting away, still lost to the world. He only regained consciousness on the way to Storm's End, and then only to mutter prayers. It was half a year and more before he was well enough to travel on to King's Landing, and in all that time Prince Viserys managed the realm as King's Hand, maintaining Balor's peace treaty with the Dornish. The realm celebrated when Balor at last regained the Iron Throne, yet Balor's interests remained firmly on the Seven, and his first new edicts must have caused consternation among those who had been used to Aegon III's sober rule, Daeron's benign neglect, and Viserys' shrewd stewardship. Having been wed in 160 AC to his sister Daenerys, the king proceeded to convince the High Septon to dissolve the marriage. It was contracted before he was king, he argued, and had never been consummated. After the union was dissolved, Balor went further by placing Daenerys and her younger sisters, Rhaena and Elaena, into their own court of beauty within the Red Keep, in what came to be called the Maiden Vault. The king announced that he wished to preserve their innocence from the wickedness of the world and the lusts of impious men. But some wondered if he did not fear the temptation of their beauty on his own behalf.
The Sisters of Baelor the First. Dana is the most famed of the three sisters, and was the most loved, for her beauty as much as her fierce courage. She was known as a skilled horsewoman, a fearsome archer with the Dornish bow her brother Darren had brought back from his conquests, and she was practiced at riding at rings, though she was never allowed to ride in a tourney, despite her efforts to the contrary. Dana quickly became known as the Defiant, for she was the most restless of the three sisters in her imprisonment, and on three separate occasions escaped disguised as a servant, or one of the small folk. She even contrived, toward the end of Baelor's reign, to get herself with child, though some might say it would have been better had she been less defiant, for all the trouble that son brought to the realm. Of Baelor's other sisters, Rhaena was almost as pious as her brother, and in time became a scepter. Elaena, the youngest, was more willful than Rhaena, but not as beautiful as either of her sisters. While in the maiden vault, it is said she cut her crowning glory, her long hair, platinum pale with a streak of gold running through it, and sent it to her brother, pleading for her freedom with the promise that, shorn as she was, she would now be too ugly to tempt any man. Her pleas fell on deaf ears, however. Elaena outlived her siblings and led a tumultuous life once freed from the maiden vault. Following in Dana's footsteps, she bore the bastard twins John and Jane Waters to Alan Velaryon, Lord Oakenfist. She hoped to wed him, it is written, but a year after his disappearance at sea, she gave up hope and agreed to marry elsewhere. She was thrice wed. Her first marriage was in 176 AC to the wealthy but aged Ossifer Plum, who is said to have died while consummating the marriage. She conceived, however, for Lord Plum did his duty before he died. Later, scurrilous rumors came to suggest that Lord Plum, in fact, died at the sight of his new bride in her nakedness. This rumor was put in the lewdest terms, terms which might have amused Mushroom, but which we need not repeat, and that the child she conceived that night was by her cousin Aegon, he who later became King Aegon the Unworthy. Her second marriage was at the behest of Aegon the Unworthy's successor, King Darren the Good. Darren wed her to his master of coin, and this union led to four more children, and to Elaena becoming known to be the true master of coin, for her husband was said to be a good and noble lord, but one without a great facility for numbers. She swiftly grew influential, and was trusted by King Darren in all things as she labored on his behalf and on that of the realm. The third marriage was one of her own choice, after she fell in love with Sir Michael Manwoody, a Dornishman who had attended Princess Mariah at her court. Manwoody, who in early life had studied at the Citadel, was a cultured man of great wit and learning, who had become a trusted servant to King Darren after Darren's marriage to Queen Mariah. He was sent to Braavos to negotiate with the Iron Bank on several occasions, and there is record of a correspondence between him and the keyholders of the Iron Bank, sealed with his seal and signed with his name, but apparently in the hand of Elaena, regarding these negotiations. Elaena wed Sir Michael, apparently with Darren's blessing, not long after her second husband died. Elaena said, in her later years, that it wasn't his intelligence that made her love Sir Manwoody, but his love of music. He was known to play the harp for her, and when he died, Elaena commanded that his effigy be carved holding a harp, and not the sword and spurs of knighthood, as is common.
Though Viserys, the princesses themselves, and other members of the court protested, the deed was done, and the princesses were cloistered away in the heart of the Red Keep accompanied only by maidens that lords and knights sent to the Red Keep to curry favour with Baelor. More protests came when Baelor went on to outlaw prostitution within King's Landing, and no one could impress on him how much trouble that would cause. More than 1,000 whores and their children, it is said, were rounded up and put out of the city. The unrest that followed was something that King Baelor chose not to acknowledge, as he busied himself with his newest project, a great sept that would be built on top of Visenya's hill, a sept that he said he had seen in a vision. So was the great sept first envisioned, though it was not completed until many years after his death. Ultimately, some have wondered if the king's near-death in Dorne did not affect his mind in some way, for as the years of his reign progressed, his decisions grew ever more zealous and erratic. Though the small folk loved him, he emptied the treasury regularly to fund his charitable acts, including the year when he donated a loaf of bread daily to every man and woman in the city. The lords of the realm were beginning to grow uneasy. The king had not only ended his marriage to Dana, but he had made sure he would never wed again by taking a septon's vows, aided and abetted by a high septon who was becoming increasingly influential in the kingdom. The king's edicts were becoming more concerned with spiritual matters at the expense of the material as well, including his effort to require the citadel to use doves, not ravens, to carry their messages. A debacle discussed at length in Walgrave's Black Wing's Swift Words, and his attempt to provide exemptions from taxation for those who ensured the virtue of their daughters through the judicious use of chastity belts. Towards the end of the reign, Baelor began to spend more and more time fasting and praying, attempting to make up for all the sins and offences he believed he and his subjects were committing against the Seven on a daily basis. When the High Septon died, Baelor informed the most devout that the gods had revealed the identity of the future High Septon to him, and they promptly elected Baelor's choice to the office. A common man named Pate, who was a gifted worker in stone, but without letters, simple-minded, and unable to recall even a simple prayer. It was a blessing, perhaps, that this lackwit High Septon only survived a year before a fever took him. Or perhaps not, for Baelor had by then become convinced that the guards had given an 8-year-old boy, a street urchin, some later claim, but more likely a draper's son, the power to perform miracles. Baelor claimed to have seen the boy speaking with doves that answered him in the voice of men and women, the voices of the Seven, according to Baelor. This, he declared, should be the next High Septon. Again, the most devout did as the king desired, and so the youngest High Septon to ever wear the crystal crown was chosen.
One unfortunate aspect of King Baelor's zealotry was his insistence on burning books. Though some books might hold little that is worth knowing, and some might even hold matter that is dangerous, destroying knowledge is a painful thing. That Baelor had the Testimony of Mushroom burned is no great surprise, given its ribald and scandalous content. But Septon Barth's Unnatural History, however mistaken some of its proposals, was the work of one of the brightest minds in the Seven Kingdoms. Barth's study and alleged practice of the higher arts proved enough to win Baelor's enmity and the destruction of his work, even though Unnatural History contains much that is neither controversial nor wicked. It is only fortunate that fragments have survived, so that the lore within was not wholly lost.
The eventual birth of Daemon Waters, the natural child of Dana Targaryen, by a father she refused to name, but whom the realm later learned was none other than her cousin Aegon, while he was still a prince, led to another fit of fasting by the king. He had already nearly killed himself some years before, when he fasted for a moon's turn, following the deaths of his cousin Princess Nere's twins shortly after their delivery. This time Balor took it further.